Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to welcome to the Salyer Report, a man who needs no introduction here, John Rapoport. I was inspired to do this conversation. It wasn't on our schedule, but we've gotten so many emails of concern from both students and professors about what's going on in the university, and John keeps knocking out one great article after another at No More Fake News and his website about this and other related sort of mind control events. So I said, John, we have to have a conversation about this. So, John, welcome back to the Salyer Report.
Always great to be here. Always great.
What's going on at the universities?
Well, a lot of things, but one of them is this business about, quote, triggering. This is now the latest and the greatest meme, and people are saying that practically anything could trigger some terrible emotional reaction from them, and therefore speech on campus, in the classroom, anywhere, has to be limited. And the other day I included a quote from a piece in the New Yorker about how one, and this is at Harvard Law School, a student was saying that the word violate should not be used in the classroom, as in this conduct violated the law, because the very word violate could trigger some student. And another example of that was students are saying, some students, that rape law should not be taught in law school because it's just too triggering. So theoretically, you could have all kinds of lawyers running around the country in the future who wouldn't have a clue about how to defend somebody or prosecute somebody on a rape charge simply because they didn't know anything about it. So this is the sort of thing that's taking place. It's the intentional affecting of vulnerability. People are being, students, teachers, everybody, are being encouraged to seek out and find and invent various ways that they could be triggered into some sort of emotional instability and some negative emotional reaction with a word spoken, a phrase spoken. And this is not just about race. It's not just about rape. It's about virtually anything. So eventually, as I proposed in one satirical piece, you could have the universities just say, well, we're going to do everything silently now. There'll be no more speech whatsoever. All courses will be silent, you know. No one may talk at any time.
Well, we've seen headlines all over the country. So we've seen headlines that clearly there was a big demonstrations and sit-in at the University of Missouri. And I think the head of the university was forced out. We saw headlines about some of the Ivy League schools, I think Yale and Princeton. You know, it's sort of happening all over the country. And one of the things I pointed out when I invited you to do this was an interview by a professor at the University of California, which I had posted on the website. It's a video from InfoWars. And I was stunned because he talked very openly about the use of entrainment and what was happening with smartphones and other technology to get kids into this kind of vulnerable space.
You bet. And that was Daryl Hamamoto. And he also spoke about retreats that students are taking on, which are managed by, you know, psychological counselors and professors of psychology and so forth, where, you know, it's just straight brainwashing into certain values, into certain, quote, sensitivities. And what, I mean, it used to be in this country that there was an idea that you wanted to try to lift people up. I'm not saying it was a universal idea, but it was present. If somebody is in a position of vulnerability, shall we say, the idea was to lift them up so that they weren't so vulnerable anymore and they could move ahead with their lives and do what they wanted to do and hopefully succeed. Now, all of this brainwashing and mind control is aimed at actually inducing more vulnerable states and pretended vulnerable states on the part of students, which is going in an entirely negative direction.
Well, here's the question. What is going on here? What's the deeper game? Because what you're watching, I've been going back and forth with different people involved in some of these situations. And what you're watching is basically a move to replace administrators and professors who won't play ball. At the same time, you're having the federal money and federal budgets move in and become more and more invasive in terms of asserting control. And so it's almost like the university is no longer controlled either by the state legislator or the endowment. It's controlled by the federal government and this sort of whoever is doing this covert op on the university. So it's a control game.
Entirely. I think that you hunted it down and found one of the bottom lines here is, along with other institutions, state institutions, there's a big move to federalize everything that moves, you know, wherever
right.
it is, let's federalize it. Police forces, wherever, you know, you can find it. Vaccine laws, laws about outlawing GMO labeling in any state. So here we have universities, and these are
right.
major targets. We're talking major targets. These are big, big institutions. And
huge.
Anything that can be done to federalize them is exactly what the federal government wants.
Well, but here's the thing, because if you look at how the money works and you go down the budgets, you know, the universities have become huge sort of economic engines, and they're unbelievably important to the economic development and real estate within a place. So they're a big piece of the economy. And if you look at Common Core and the testing and Obamacare, you know, essentially what you've got is the feds and some covert operations moving in on education and healthcare across the board. The whole GNP that gets thrown off by healthcare and education is getting moved on. And so this is clearly about, and, you know, if you look at the general economy, we're clearly in a deflation. And, you know, when you're in a deflation, the powers that be grab for every piece of cash they can. But I just want to go down some of the cash flows, because when you look at a university, you know, and you say, well, how could the feds control a state university? If you look at the money, research, you know, the research grants and the research money has gotten bigger and bigger at a lot of these universities. And these universities are doing very sensitive research with advanced technology. So if you look at all the things we're doing with, you know, crazy things that you've covered on junk science, if you're going to keep getting junk science out of universities, you've got to have tighter control.
No question about it. I agree. And then look at, for example, all the Pentagon contracts at universities,
right.
developing
right.
weapons and so forth. So it all comes together there. It's like a nexus of federal money.
Right. And then you've got a very important one, which is, you know, you're trying to promote all sorts of policies. So you know, I used to do this when I was studying Harvard. You used to see, you know, some Harvard professor trotted out and said, oh, this is good for the country because of blah, blah. So we had, you know, Harvard, all these Harvard professors were basically promoting whatever was going to make Enron money. You know.
All right.
So part of it is just getting a lockdown and control of that intellectual capital. But another thing I've noticed is, you know, you're bringing in tremendous numbers of foreign students. So, you know, you've got millions of foreign students every year coming in, and, you know, they're getting scholarships and other money to go to, particularly in the graduate programs. So you can see graduate programs where, you know, 80% or 90% of the kids are foreign. And, you know, half of the university is funded with state appropriations. And I can see why you would want to distract people from noticing that, especially as the economy gets tighter and tighter.
Yeah, you certainly wouldn't want to blow up about that. You wouldn't want some, you know, demographic studies to come out and say, guess how much money all colleges and universities in America are giving away to foreign students, especially
right.
when politicians like to yak about developing American exceptionalism here, and especially in science and math and so forth. I mean, this would tend to run
right.
counter to the narrative, to say the least.
Right. Right. And then there's the student loan. I just want to run through the different pots of money. They're the student loans. So instead of kids being able to go to college, you know, I think everybody should be able to go to college essentially for free. You know, the feds, all the state universities, all the universities are dependent on the feds directly or indirectly for the student loans. So that's another pot of federal money and control. And then on top of it, a lot of these universities have health care. You know, they have hospitals and healthcare programs, and those have gotten completely tied up and tied down with Obamacare. So if you're going to keep doing these, all these different insane policies, you're going to need tighter control of the university. So from my vantage point, I'm just looking at this and saying, you know, given what's happening with the economy and given the fact that the policies that the pro-centralization team is trying to implement, you know, basically they're trying to implement stuff which is scientifically, legally, and morally insane. And the only way they can do that is if they have complete lockdown control of the universities.
Yeah, I agree. In the case, by the way, of the University of Missouri, that was the original protest that sparked this current wave of political correctness. This was mentioned in the press, but it was quickly kind of scrubbed. And that was that the University of Missouri has a major football team, and half the football team was supporting the protests on campus. The University of Missouri is part of the Southeastern Conference, which is the richest college football conference. We're talking about billions of dollars, television contracts, major television networks of their own, coverage wall to wall on ESPN, advertisers. And if the University of Missouri football team decided that they were not going to play their next game, they were going to lose a few million dollars or $1 million right off the bat as a penalty for not sticking to their schedule. And then if that had gone on, and we're now talking about games that the team would be playing within its own conference, chaos, absolute chaos would result. I mean, college football, I don't know how many Solari listeners are aware of this, but I mean, this is giant business we're talking about.
Yeah, it is giant business.
This is why the president had to resign in a day. Excuse me. This is why the president had to just get out, because the students were calling for him to resign. And again, we're talking about money here. In this case, we're talking about major corporate money. But we're also talking about huge numbers of scholarships for football players and athletes in general. We're talking about Title IX, which is a federal program for equality among men's and women's sports. And the women's sports are largely funded by profits from the football programs. It all interlocks, and it all makes a very rather grotesque money picture.
Well, who's doing this? In other words, if you look at the technology, I mean, I'm assuming this is being delivered through the smartphones and the media. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely fair to say.
So to deliver it through the media, you need basically the telecoms and the intelligence agencies.
I think so, sure. I mean, the entire, upper education system of America, as you've indicated, as far as the money flows are concerned, the idea is to make that totally captive in every respect. The research,
right.
the grant monies, the values of the students, what they're for, what they're against, what they think, how little they think, how bad their education really turns out to be. And that's another whole issue, which is that the value, intrinsic value of an education has plummeted over the last couple of decades to the point where many people wouldn't even recognize it in terms of what's permitted in the classroom, what gets a passing grade, what passes for the ability to read and write competently. All of these things are taking a backseat to supposed social values, and the professors are under the gun to go along with it. Some of them go along with it voluntarily because their own educations have been, you know, imperfect to say the least, but a lot of other professors are just bulldozed into going along with this kind of program. So education per se is nothing compared to what it used to be.
Right. Well, here's the question, John, because you look at now what we're getting is an explosion of access to information and knowledge. So if you look at the ease with which anybody who wants to provide an excellent education for themselves can, you know, it's if you take the amount of money you spend, what does it cost now to go to an Ivy League university? Any idea?
At least a couple $100,000, maybe more.
So let's say it costs $200,000 to get an Ivy League university education if you go straight through, okay? And probably incidentals is another $50,000. So say it's $250,000. If you said to an 18-year-old, you have $250,000 to make sure you get an absolutely first-rate liberal arts education for the next 4 years, put yourself together a curriculum, I want you to travel the world studying and learning from the best and the brightest all over the world. I dare say for $250,000, you could put together something quite smashing, right?
You're right. No question about it.
Right. So we're reaching the point where if you look at the dysfunction and costs of going to K through 12 public school and then an Ivy League university in America, you know, as an economic matter, if you're a parent, you know, it's really time to invent Plan B, because this is, you know, how can you send your child to a university and hope that that child's going to get a decent education?
You can't. I don't see why anybody in the liberal arts or humanities, which includes history, would even think of going to college. I mean, there are a few.
Right.
Okay, I can understand, yeah. But armed with a list of maybe 30 great books and a real teacher who's steeped in knowledge of what those books are and what, you know, the context is.
Right.
Within 2 or 3 years, you could get a far better education than you could at 95% of the colleges in America. And you
would be paying,
you know, next to nothing relative
right.
of the costs of an Ivy League education.
Well, one of the best educated people I ever met was, I asked her how she had gotten such a fabulous education. And she said, when my parents moved to the United States, they realized how bad the educational system was. So we used to move school districts every 6 months so that we could be homeschooled. And they would never catch up with us because we just kept moving. And my parents realized to make sure that I had a good education, they just had to commit to being nomadic.
Wow. Yeah, and I don't think you even have to do that these days. I mean, I think there are easier ways to do it.
Yeah.
The only thing that you're lacking is the college-level diploma, you know, the stamp and the seal of approval. And, in the marketplace after college, you have to be inventive to figure out how to overcome that ridiculous seal of approval in getting a job or whatever it is.
Couldn't you overcome that by going to a foreign university?
Yes, and I think that there are probably a number of them that would be way out beyond what's available to get in the United States. But I'm also suggesting that a process of self-education in the sense that you are reading the right books, and you have somebody at your disposal, a mentor, which is, you know, the pattern in, say, some British universities traditionally, you're reading in a certain subject. That's the way they put it. Well, that means you read and you read and you've got somebody to talk to who is far more educated than you are in that material, and you're writing papers and you're doing research. You're learning how to do research. You're learning how to think. This is light years beyond what you get at most U.S. colleges and universities.
Right. I put up the video for called The School about the it's high school equivalent in Russia. It's in the it's a private school that was put together and where the kids basically work as each other's teachers, and they teach themselves under the guidance of a principal and a variety of people. It's quite it's the most extraordinary school I've ever seen. But but it shows you. So the kids kind of decide what they're going to learn, and then they immerse themselves. So during the film, one of the things they decided was they were going to study physics. And so they study physics until they say, okay, well, we got that. So it's time to move on. And so you had this 13-year-old explaining physics to her fellow students, and your mouth dropped because it's college level stuff. And they're just sitting around immersed in learning this. It's quite extraordinary. Anyway, so it's inspiring to see what is possible. Well, I want to tie back what we're watching at U.S. universities to things we've been watching going on around the world, which is, you know, young people organizing and coming together and behaving in these ways in Egypt, or then, you know, recently in Hong Kong or Occupy Wall Street. How much of that is entrainment driven?
I'm sorry to say that I think a great deal of it is. And the proof of the pudding is when you see the demands, they're usually couched in these laughingly vague generalities. For example, if you look up Amherst College, which happens to be my alma mater, and by the way, the students who are protesting there have demanded that the administration warn alumni like myself not to write or speak anything critical of the protests. So
what?
I guess that, oh yeah. So that means me, because I graduated in 1960. So according to these students, I should not be publicly criticizing their protests. And they have asked the administration to send out some kind of a warning to the alumni lists. I haven't gotten any, so I don't think that happened. But, you know, you start to get the flavor of this. Well, if you read the statement of demands of this group of students at Amherst, we demand that the administration put an end to or speak out effectively against. And then there's a whole list of about 15 isms, racism, this ism, that ism, and so on and so forth. And you get to the end of the statement and you're saying, what level of intelligence is operating here? I mean, it's like, we want you to specifically denounce the following list of incredibly vague things, wherever they may be occurring on campus, in town, in the world, in the country, on Jupiter, Mars, wherever, you know, there might be some ism happening, to absolutely denounce it. And, you know, so if this isn't entrainment, I don't know what is. On some level, these students have been gotten to,
right,
through indoctrination in the classroom, through the ubiquitous presence of cell phones and television sets and laptops, to, you know, drop their IQ by at least a dozen, if not more, points. And
see, I think they should be walking in and saying, why isn't tuition free?
Sure. Or,
in other words, if you're going to protest, you need to protest about the right thing. Or how come we're not telling the truth in our scientific research about GMOs? Or,
exactly. Or,
right.
Or here is a list of specific grants. This is my gripe. Here are a list of 37 grants that have been given to researchers at the college for the following experiments and so forth. And you run all of this down, Pentagon, toxic pharmaceutical, you know, and okay, here's the list. This is how the college is surviving through this money. These right. are the professors who are engaging in the research. We demand an end to this because right. of the following reasons. Now you're getting real. Now you're getting specific. This is not entrainment now. This is research. This is what college students are supposed to be able to do. But apparently, not only can't they do it, it doesn't even occur to them to try.
Well, so what you've got is you've got the student body, you know, fighting ghosts and yeah. and avoiding reality.
Exactly. You know, right. we demand an end to racism everywhere all at once. Okay, sure. No problem. Let's see. How about dinner tonight? We'll have it done by then, you know? I mean, it's just lunacy. And but there's tremendous pressure once these protests are launched to go along with it, pressure on other students. At Amherst, for example, there were a few students who put up posters saying that free speech should be allowed, meaning, well, if we don't agree with these protests, we should be allowed to present our side. And so part of the demands of the protesters were that these posters be taken down and that this kind of free speech should not be allowed on campus, right?
Right.
Nobody blinks. Nobody says, this is insane. This is against everything we stand for. No, they don't seem to be.
You know, it's funny. People get so scared because I lived through a process where I was targeted by this kind of stuff. And it was so amazing. There was this great moment because the press, and I think they were using entrainment too, was accusing me of money laundering. And so I had a system set up in my company where every check had to be signed twice. And one was the chief financial officer, and the other person was always somebody other than me. I signed no checks. And the cash flows had to be published every month on the intranet so that most of the employees who were shareholders could see, you know, so everything was fully, all the money was fully disclosed and all the checks were signed, you know, by two people. So my chief financial officer was an unbelievably competent, capable professional, come from one of the big eight firms. He was kind of our star employee. And he came in and he said, you know, I got up this morning and I said, I bet she really is laundering money. I bet she is. And then I said, well, wait a minute. Since I control the bank accounts and I'm signing the checks, if she's laundering money, I'm doing it. And he said, I'm not doing it, so you can't be doing it. But why am I thinking that you have to be doing it? Because
wow.
it's so powerful. Do you know what
yeah.
I mean? It's so powerful. It's amazing. You know, and we did a great Salieri report on entrainment where I talked with Adam Trombley. And I tell him the story of being in a speech where they were using entrainment, and I knew they were. And I got busy taking notes, and I forgot to kind of say, you know, control your mind. And I suddenly put down my pen and started clapping and saying, turned to the next guy and said, isn't he wonderful? And what he was saying was dreadful, and he was dreadful, and I didn't mean it. It was like, I just lost my mind.
You know where else this comes from? And I've always railed against this. It just seems unbelievable to me. I don't know when this started, maybe in the middle 60s at colleges and universities. The whole idea of study groups. When I went to college, basically, you know, you went to the library and you studied laboriously.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you had a lot of work to do. You would read and you would write and so forth. And then at some point after I left, I don't know when, this idea started to grow up of study groups, which to me was kind of like, well, this is a great way to cheat because we'll get five or six of us together. We'll all study for the exam together. And, of course, some people will be smarter than others, and they'll tell the others what to look for and what's right and what's wrong. And this kind of mitigates the whole process of the individual doing his or her own work and advancing in intellectual skill, competence, and confidence and all of that. It's all the group, the group, the group. And this spread out all over, certainly, the United States. And you can even see this. I'm trying to think of the which movie this was. I think it was The Paper Chase, where you just see casually, as a matter of course, students at Harvard sitting around, you know, in their study group, which is the most important thing that they did. That's the way it was presented. Well, I want to be in the study group, and no, you can't be because you're a drag on the rest of us, and you show up late, and we're all going to sit around and, you know, go over this particular legal issue because, you know, somebody's going to call on this and blah, 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 blah. Where did this come from? Well, once you introduce this whole idea into colleges of the group, the group, the group, the group, you're already entraining people's minds. And from there on to getting to, look, the real purpose of the group is to be a group and to have values and to push those values onto the college and force them to comply because we have power. Oh, I see. So now we can do that. But once that begins, you see how intellectually bankrupt these students are because they really have nothing specific to talk about. It's all gone.
Yeah, but real power comes from either getting your education for free as opposed to having to go into debt to pay for it, or from having the intellectual capital you need to go navigate the world and do something, you know, important.
Yeah, yourself.
And what you're doing is you're going in the opposite direction on both counts.
Exactly. You're going in the opposite direction. And just to add a little footnote here, I'm going to say it was sometime in the 1980s. I spoke with a dean of students at UCLA, and we were talking about inter-student group competition and conflict on the campus, various student groups, God knows how many of them there were. And he said, there's one thing you have to understand here. They're competing for money. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you know, we give money to student groups. I said, really? He said, oh, yeah, they have budgets. And they do different things with their money. So naturally, they're going to be at each other's throats to try to get the money. And they're going to say and do anything like the most venal politicians would in order to discredit their opponents and to get the cash. And I said, and this is going on all the time? He said, absolutely. He said, since the end of the Vietnam War, or since the end of the draft, when that specter was taken off of the students' minds, it all devolved into the student groups who were competing for money. And I'm sure that if somebody wanted to do deep research on it, you would find that on campuses all over the United States, under the surface, this is still going on. And this whole idea of the group and now the group trying to get money. What money? You know, you have a meeting, you talk, you have an agenda, you pursue it. What's the money for? The money is just a kind of a salve that the university lays on students to try to kind of make them more soft and, you know, less sharp as individuals.
Okay, so now I want to drill down into a different game because on one hand, you have entrainment being used to encourage students, including in lots of universities in the heartland, to you know, promote the most disgusting, repulsive form of political correctness. And on the other hand, you have entrainment being used to promote a political candidate who's kind of a New York version of Hitler, running around and promoting, you know, the idea that we need to control the internet, no problem, just ask Bill Gates, he'll figure it out. We need to be able to have the government to shut down houses of worship. We need to be able to have the government create special databases and require ID cards. We need warrantless searches. So he's basically, and we need to be free to waterboard and torture. So he's basically taking the dream CIA, you know, the most you know, domestic rendition centers, if you will. He's basically, you know, using the same technology to promote totalitarianism into an angry heartland that's angry about all this political correctness stuff. And so you've got, I don't know if you've noticed, you've got, you know, you've got a divide and conquer here that's going on that's very intense, because you've got everyone in the heartland so angry about how ridiculous it's gotten that they're going, yeah, 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 and supporting something which is the opposite of what conservatives are supposed to support. Do you notice that there's a...
Yeah, sure. I mean, divide and conquer is obviously happening, you know, at the highest level. But then, you know, if you look at the backup, the backups who may eventually become the front runners, Hillary and Jeb, when the dust clears, you know, now you're talking about neocons and war, and let's
right.
find a good war, and that one isn't so good, but here's three over here we can do right away, and, you know, give more money for more weapons to be produced, and so on and so forth. The camp used to be places where at least some students were able to see these things, but that has disappeared.
It's almost as though they're losing the math skills to look at the money and understand the money.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. And the writing skills to set down something cogent and specific about what's going on. You know, it's on every level. It's happening. Again, why would anybody who is interested in what's loosely referred to as the liberal arts and the humanities, why would anyone want to go to college in America? It's quite beyond me, absolutely beyond me. And I told you yesterday, as we were talking on the phone, about one of my professors at Amherst, who had just come there from the Midwest a year or so before I graduated. And I kind of kept track of him a little bit. And about 10 to 15 years later, he was angrily writing about the fact, he was a teacher of philosophy, that none of, or most of his students couldn't write, or a lot of them couldn't write. And so he was refusing to read their papers unless they could spell, know what a comma was and where to use it and so forth. Just, you know, the basics you're supposed to learn in high school and junior high. He was saying, I'm not going to read these papers. I'm not going to give you a grade. You have to keep working on it until it's presentable. So let's say this was in the mid-70s, 25, 40 years ago. At that time, his students went into a convulsion about this, absolute convulsion, as if this was not important. They saw no value in this. How dare he challenge them and insist on anything as egregious as being able to write? And, you know, his blood boiled, and he just stuck to his guns, and that's the way it was. But I'm sure a lot of other professors just shined it on and let their students, you know, slip through. So no matter which way you look at this whole thing, from whatever angle and how deep you drill down, what is the value of this? It just seems entirely negative to me, what used to be called a good college education.
Well, let me get back to something, and that is the model. Because if you look at the university model in this country, you know, I don't think the university model was designed, and certainly after they morphed it after World War II, the university was not designed to produce educated people, humans. It was designed to basically run investment syndicates. So if you look at the Harvard Corporation, you have an endowment, which is essentially an investment syndicate. And instead of paying taxes, it throws off a certain amount of money to the college. And then the college provides the intellectual air cover that the investment syndicate needs. And it produces people that serve the investment syndicate in a variety of ways. And so,
well,
whether...
Would you just say that again? Just
yeah,
go
so
that little thing, because
so I have an intergenerational pool of capital, and I want to protect it from taxes. I put it in a corporation called the Harvard Corporation, but I could do the same for Yale or the other universities. I put it in a corporate structure which is controlled and operated by a self-perpetuating board. So the board you know, if somebody resigns, the board picks a new person who comes on. So they're self-perpetuating. The money is in the corporation, and the money is held tax exempt because I have a university, and instead of paying, you know, an enormous amount of taxes on my money, I'm tax free because I'm supporting a university. But I only give the university about 4 or 5% every year, which is significantly less than I would pay in taxes, right? So what a good deal. Now, what I do with that university is I get that university to write studies that say what my companies want to do is good. I get the university to put people in government who do what's good for my investment syndicate. And then I have lots of people who I get first dibs on in terms of getting the, you know, good employees and good people to work in my companies, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I go to the university and I get great photo ops that makes me look like I care and I'm a good citizen. So if you look at that 4% that I'm spinning off to the, you know, the university, you know, what I watched with the housing bubble is Harvard make a huge amount of money and basically stick, you know, trillions of dollars or hundreds of billions of dollars of losses to the U.S. taxpayer. And I kept writing articles saying, you know, well, why should they be tax exempt if we just pick up all their messes? You know, they should share in the cost of their messes. What's going on here? But it's, you know, you and I, when we did that great Salieri report on the best documentaries, we talked about Norman Dodd's interview with Ed Griffith, who, you know, where he talks about this model, the Tax Exempt Foundation. We've certainly seen it with the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation. And this very much goes back to those foundations, and I'll tell you why. While we had our, you know, the Trump Hitler screaming about how we needed to control the internet, it was no problem, just get Bill Gates to figure it out. The same day, Buffett's announcing he's doing a big fundraiser for Hillary. And, you know, what you have to understand is the Trumps and the Clintons are good friends, and the Clintons have a foundation. They're running around the world racketeering, you know, and so somebody wants to pay the Secretary of State a bribe to get, you know, some policy from the United States government. Her husband goes, gets to pay $1.5 million to, you know, to give a speech. Now, do you really think that he's being paid to give a speech? Or that's, you know, it goes on and on. I did a great review. There's a new book called Clinton Cash that describes the whole game. And it's just, you know, it's out of control and it's outrageous, but it's all played with tax-exempt money. And of course, you know, the air cover for all of it is the soft revolution. We are here to help you. Same with the Gates Foundation. And now we have Zuckerberg putting his money in. So, you know, the model of the tax-exempt university or the tax-exempt foundation is very much at the heart of this game.
You bet. I mean, that's a killer. That is a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, say, the University of California system, where state where I live, this is like a separate nation. They have campuses everywhere, big campuses, big, real big campuses, and money pouring in, and departments expanding, like the so-called health sciences and medical research and this and that, you know, federal money, corporate money, state money, any kind of money you can imagine. And so at the bottom of the totem pole is the student. The student is just the excuse for all of this to happen, just like
right.
Commercials are the real reason there's television and the program. You know, and the interruptions between the commercials. In the same way, the student is just the incidental cost of doing business. Okay, so we have to have...
Well, but they want the student...
...running around to give the impression that we're doing education here when
right.
we're really laundering money. So let's, you know, while we're at it, we may as well make over these students into what we want them to be.
Right.
By any means necessary, retreats, in-classroom indoctrination, pressure groups on campus. Where did they come from? We don't know. Overnight, 60 students suddenly showed up with one unified message. I mean, come on. You know, this is all just a front. Who started this? Who put the money in and who talked to the leader of that group and educated, in heavy quotes, him to be the spokesman for this ridiculous, politically correct idea? You know, let's
right.
just make these campuses into mind control factories for the little students running around so that, as you say, we turn out the people in the way we want them to be, to occupy the positions in society we want them to occupy that will benefit our corporation,
syndicate,
our foundation, our government, our this, our yeah. that, our establishment, our intelligence agency, our military, on and on and on.
It's funny. I one subscriber many years ago wrote and said, you know, my father was a big muckety-muck in the Masons, and after World War II, they said, oh, we're moving it all into the university because it's too obvious when we all go down to the lodge. And I started to watch patterns of everybody going to the football games. And what I realized is, oh, that's a cover story. They're going to football games, but then they're having meetings. And nobody notices. There's a great James Bond movie. It was one of the recent ones where they all go to the opera, but some of them get special microphones so they can have a meeting while the music is playing.
Yeah,
it's the co-located true. Stacked functions meetings. And when the Penn State pedophilia thing happened, they're like, you know, how could this be going on when somebody's going there for the games? And I thought, no, they're not going there just for the games.
That's right. That's exactly how it is going on.
Right.
Because you've got all these cover stories, layers and layers of cover stories at the universities that are covering up what you're really talking about here, the tax-free you know, investment fund and the money laundering and all of this. This is the business that's going on. So a parent with a child who's saying, well, gee, you got into such and so university. That's great. No, it's not. It's horrible. You know, it's horrible that this kid is going to be subjected to what he's going to be subjected to for 4 years.
Right, it's not safe.
In fact, he could become much smarter through much simpler and less expensive means.
Right. Right. And so, you know, this gets us to the problem. We're watching, you know, I have an expression called shriek-o-meter. So during the election last year, the Ebola shriek-o-meter got going and was very effective. It, you know, the Republicans won the Senate because they turned up the Ebola shriek-o-meter. It was a very effective tactic. No, I have to say. So we're watching the shriek-o-meter. You know, Trump is certainly doing the Hitler shriek-o-meter, and it's, you know, so far it's working. But the shriek-o-meter is turning up, and I think the reason the shriek-o-meter is turning up, John, is with the deflation, you have significant drops in cash flows in oil and gas and agriculture. You know, now it's translating into drops in retail, and you're really seeing a deflationary force work its way through the economy. People are getting scared, you know, and it's getting, if the Hitler shriek-o-meter is turned up this loud, it's getting really serious. And so the problem becomes that if you look across our whole society, the lies have gotten layered. You know, we come out of World War II and we start telling incredible lies, more lies, more lies, more, you know, and it just keeps getting worse. They're layered, and we've reached a point where we can't have an intelligent discussion about what we do about things because you've got the sort of the forces of, you know, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, the Clintons, the Bushes, all these guys, you know, turning on a new shriek-o-meter. They don't see a way to govern without shriek-o-meters. And at this point, the shriek-o-meter has, you know, reached a level of entrainment and you know, Orwellianness that I think, you know, I think one of the things that's contributing to deflation is you have very sensible, intelligent, capable people saying, you know, this is so not under adult supervision. You know, I've stopped thinking of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett as adults. I now think of them as children with money.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like little boys pulling the wings off of flies when they're 12 years old. You know, the bullies in the classroom. I mean, it's not adult behavior. And that scares me.
Well, it's a good thing that we're talking about education in light of what you've just said, because it all starts there. You know, if you have sufficient numbers of young people who are alert, well-educated, independent, thinking, and not just randomly independent. I mean, they can actually follow a line of reasoning and thought from the beginning to end, and they can analyze it. And they're steeped in great books. They can actually sit down and read books and talk about them with somebody who is far more experienced than they are and see all of the implications and so on and so forth. If you have sufficient numbers of these individuals at ground level, they will think of things to do that you can't predict when they become adults, young adults.
Right.
This is, to me, a great place to start. A breakaway, in a good sense breakaway, education alternative for kids who are, you know, 17, 18 years old. Not
right.
to get into the system, not to get into the syndicate, not to get into the throwaway life, but to go in a different direction, because that's one of the only solutions that's around. And people should, you know, start thinking about this very, very seriously.
Right.
I can point to experiences that I had at the college level where I would read a book and talk about that book with somebody who was far more educated than I was. And in the process of the education, I learned things and gained my own spontaneous insights that stood me in good stead decades later from one book.
Right.
This is not happening anymore. This is absolutely not happening. But it could. It could.
Right.
Decentralization of what's laughingly called a college education could lead to something like this in many different places.
It's funny, one of the highest compliments I ever got on the Slayer Report, one subscriber wrote in, she was a college student, she said, "It's so great now when I go into history class, when they start lying to me, I just put in my, you know, my headphone in one of my ears and listen to this Slayer Report and laugh and laugh and laugh because the lies aren't working."
Exactly.
So I always tell everybody, you know, when I can't stand it, when I'm at the, I always do this when I'm at the airport, when I can't, you know, when the TVs are on everywhere, I put my headset on and I listen to you. And I laugh and laugh and laugh because the lies aren't working. Well, I think, you know, I think the question for everybody listening to this is, you know, what do we do? And the reality in our lives, John, is in every aspect of our lives, we're paying taxes to organizations which are using that money to do something that harms us. And, you know, that's not an economic model that can last. So we're either going to have to find a way to stop paying the money, or we're going to have to find a way to you know, to stop them harming us, or both. I mean, ideally both. And you're right. There's nothing more important than education. And if you're going to debase and corrupt the intellectual capital of a society to the extent that we're watching it, then there's no future. I mean, that's the scary thing to me about what's going on, is you're looking at the destruction of the intellectual capital and the intellectual culture and growth of an entire society. And it almost reminds me of an intellectual version of what we did to Iraq. If you ever saw Charlie Ferguson's documentary on the sort of the takeover of Iraq and the destruction of civil society.
I haven't.
And I associate this very much with a neocon. You know, these are very neocon tactics, which is why I get back to who's really designing this. Who are the brains behind the operation?
I think you would certainly find some folks on Wall Street who early on figured out exactly what you described. Hey, we got a university. Guess what? Nonprofit, not taxable. Investment fund, money, corporate interests, government interests. Wow, what could be a better setting for the operation that we.
I will bet you at a lot of these universities, what you're watching is the bank accounts and the money management and a lot of the financial stuff, the bonds. You know, if you go down their balance, their assets and their positions, that's getting moved as a result of these different wars.
Oh,
you know, and you're right, the sports stuff, you know, but if you look at a university, let's look at a university as a target for a second. So you're talking about the sports stuff, right? So TV, all of that. Then you've got the management of the endowment. You've got the bank accounts. You've got all the professor positions. If you can, you know, move everybody out and put your guys in, you're talking about scholarships, right? You're talking about control of research grants and all sorts of research other things, you know, so the capacity to get people or put people in who will just, you know, write studies that say, oh, this, you know, black is white and white is black. So you're talking about a huge flow of potential business that can generate a lot of money on publicly traded stocks.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. The way I see it, it's just, it makes no rational sense what's going on in these institutions. Zero. But what you're talking about, that pattern, the money, that makes perfect sense. That's what.
Right. They're running hits. And they're running hits so that they can get control of the different, you know, the different treats, the different pots.
It's kind of like the drug business, you know. Well, we got the mafia, you know. We got to go legit now. We got to make money here, right? So how are we going to go legit? Well, we're going to invest in, you know, we're going to own some businesses. Oh, but wait a minute. I got a better idea, you know. Universities, let's go there, you know. That's the real, you know, solution. That's the way it works. If I had a kid and I were a parent and that kid were 18 and he was certainly, you know, curious about life and the world and wanted to further his or her education, I would look until I found two or three people that I considered great teachers, highly educated.
Right, scholars.
And I would pay them and I would say, okay, you know, here's a very bright person for you to teach.
Right.
Go at it for 4 years, 3 years. And I would know absolutely that something far, far better was happening than would happen if he or she were going to an American college.
Okay, so let me walk you through, because I want your help. What I'm doing is I'm getting an email from, and I'll just use a you know, sort of a standardized example from all of them. A professor writes me and says, what's happening? And I say, well, you know, first you got to learn about entrainment. So I give them the Adam Trombley interview and I give them the interview of the professor from University of California explaining what's happening. So then they got to digest that. And then I have to explain to them the fact that there's no privacy and surveillance. So I did a blog post. I did a whole review on sort of tactics of, you know, what the telecoms and these other companies are up to, called, I think it was Technologies of Control. So I give them that link. And then I give them the link for control files. These are people who don't even know control files exist. They don't know what a control file is. Somebody said, what's a control file? I said, oh, this is going to take a while. So they've got to grapple with the fact that, you know, the chancellor of the university has a control file. And the fact that there's no privacy, you know, everybody's under surveillance, and then there's such a thing as mind control, and these kids who are walking around looking like, you know, World War Z and zombies, you know, are under the influence. But then they've got to start looking at the university as a pot of money, so I have to walk them through that. And it's an awful lot to learn, and part of it is just fathoming that things have gotten this bad. You know, you have people who, until this happened, felt safe. So they felt physically safe. They felt intellectually safe. They felt free to say whatever they wanted. You know, because they thought this was something that just happens in poor neighborhoods. It doesn't happen here. And now the same game that shook down you know, the South Bronx 25 years is, you know, moving into Yale.
You bet. And yeah. One other factor that I neglected to mention, talking about zombies, the psychological services areas of these
companies. Oh, yes, please.
Expanded beyond anything that you would believe if you went to college, say, 20 years ago. So now every student knows that if he or she has a problem, can go to psychological services and get diagnosed. Oh, I have ADHD. Well, everybody does. No big deal. Now I can get some speed called Ritalin or Adderall so I can study better for my exams. Or I can be clinically depressed and take one of the SSRIs like Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil, and I'll feel a jolt into a kind of a manic state, which, yeah, well, eventually we'll get to be depression again, and then bipolar, and then I'll get something else. And, you know, the victims are created. And after these diagnoses are handed out and the toxic drugs are handed out, now you look around the campus, and indeed you see people who are ideal candidates for further brainwashing.
Right.
They are already in a highly vulnerable, entrained state, chemically speaking. And now you can do all sorts of things to those people that you wouldn't have been able to do before. This is really the predecessor to the triggering thing that I was talking about at the beginning here. Once you've established, we got 300 possible mental disorders, and we'll assign you one or two and drug you and this and that, and this goes on long enough, now you can convince people quite easily that their real job in life is to dream up all the ways they can be triggered into negative emotions and to begin protesting against that in a completely irrational way that solves nothing. You can do that. And that's what is being done.
One of the things I think it's so hard for people to understand that this is going on is because, you know, I spent a lot of time when I was working in the government and then working as a financial advisor dealing with what could be done with relational databases and artificial intelligence. And I think it's hard for people to understand that, you know, the somewhere in the world, it's really embedded in the defense contractors, but the telecoms have it too. You have, and the search engines have it. You have extraordinary databases with every imaginable piece of information about your money, time, and habits and all sorts of stuff on every human being, certainly in the United States. And those databases, very dynamically using software and artificial intelligence, can figure out, you know, ops like this and implement them at relatively low expense. This does not, you know, it's funny, I remember somebody saying to me, well, Snowden can't make any sense. There's no way. They can only track at least 25,000 people. I said, don't be ridiculous. With relational databases and artificial intelligence, they can track every person all the time in real time and use it dynamically to make money. Are you crazy? But they couldn't fathom that. They couldn't fathom, you know, that this had reached a whole new level of sophistication.
Yeah. That escapes most people as to how far advanced the technology really is. Because, you know, well, how would they do that? And how does it work? And this and that and the other thing. Well, they've had super IQ kids, you know, working like drones for a long time to advance the technology of computers and databases and hooking them all up and cross-indexing and so forth. And once you lay out the patterns of how it works, it's not all that difficult to keep on pushing it and connecting all the information up that you want to. And so just the fact of people carrying cell phones wherever they go all the time, it's like they're saying, hey, spy on me, I'm here, and now I'm here, and now I'm here, and now I'm doing this, and now I'm buying that. You know, spy on me.
When I was at Hamilton, my wonderful chief financial officer came to me and he said, we have to have a personnel system and I want to hire this firm to do a person. I said, I'm not doing that. And I'm not spending money on that. And I said, no, here's what we're going to do. At bonus time, everybody has to write their own evaluation. We're going to require them to learn HTML they're going to write their evaluation as a page on the internet, and then we'll link the pages together, and that will be our personnel system, and they will maintain their own page. So that was 1995. So then Facebook comes along, and I realized, oh, you know, that's what the CIA is doing. It's way too much data servicing expense to keep files on everybody. So what they're going to do is they're going to have everybody update their own file, and that way they can see the connections between people dynamically. And they're going to figure out a way to make money on it, which is why when Mark Zuckerberg said he was going to put 99% of the stock in an LLC, you know, it ain't his money.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right, but before you want to keep your file updated for the intelligence agencies, you might want to think twice about it.
And speaking of Facebook, just gauge the effect of, let's say you've got a university where there's 40,000 students.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all on Facebook. And they're all updating this and updating that and blah, 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 like this, like that, whatever. So what does this imply? It implies that you're emphasizing the connectivity on the most superficial level possible, but nevertheless, the connectivity among all of these students, plus all of the people that they know and all the people that they know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the game that supersedes anything that happens in the classroom or what the professor has to say or whatever. It's like, I don't want to fall behind on Facebook. So the relational group collective aspect of the whole campus is now emphasized to the greatest degree, just as a matter of course of living every day. The kids are doing that all the time. So how do you think the individual is going to stack up against this? I mean, suppose some individual with a crazy idea decides, well, I'm going to put my latest essay on Dostoevsky on my Facebook page, link to it, and bring up a couple of, you know, the most important issues in crime and punishment and this and that and the other thing and see how many people like it. Are you crazy? You know, that's not going to work. That's not going to stand. That's ridiculous. You've got to go for the most lowest common denominator if you want to be liked, if you want to relate, if you want to connect. This goes against completely the traditional idea of higher education, where it's all about the individual and his or her progress, merit, competence, you know, imagination, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this sets the stage for everything else that we're talking about. It just
makes, you know, to a certain extent, John, you needed to run these kind of covert ops on a university or any kind of enterprise. You know, Facebook came out of the universities, so its focus has been to organize the, you know, databases on the universities that you could use to do this. But you needed everybody in Facebook. You needed everybody having a smartphone. You needed the cell tower and satellite systems in place. And so to a certain extent, it may not just be deflation that's driving this. It's that the build-out of the infrastructure you need to run major mind control and covert operations on a university has now reached a level of maturity.
I believe it has. I believe you're absolutely right. That this is what you see, you know. And if you now add even one more factor, that 90% of the professors who are now employed, at least on these campuses, have nothing interesting or important to say in their classrooms and lectures, then why bother even attending? You know, just leave your cell phone on a chair and record what they say and kind of skim through it, or, you know, there's the entire core of what it means to be part of a real educational institution is shattered. There's no reason for it anymore. It doesn't work, except that you have a few outlier professors who are on the fringe, who are really educating people. And I know a few of those. They're under the gun. They're always having problems with the administration, plus their own departments. people are looking for ways to get rid of them or cut their salaries or reduce their responsibilities or even turn their students against them to make life miserable for them. Those are the best of the teachers who are now trying to survive on campuses.
Right. I think the places where you see some serious activity is anything that the federal research or military research wants. You know, and if you particularly, that's where you're getting a lot of the foreign students. And I think one reason they may want to cycle in so many foreigners is it's going to be easier for them to be gung-ho and, you know, and in doing some of the stuff they want to do. But when you're looking at doing all sorts of new technology or advanced technology, so if you're looking at doing cloning, or you're looking at doing new material sciences, or you know, you're seeing lots of money pour into that, and you are getting, you know, critical masses of people with tons of resources doing stuff. Now, it's not necessarily stuff that you and I might think, you know, will make the world a better place, but you are getting, you know, massive resources, labs, research, people, critical masses of smart people going at it. And I think so there, you know, there are areas in engineering where I would not want to learn myself. I would need the certification, and I would want to be around a lot of people who knew about it.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. But on the other hand, I see it as, you know, captured intellectual capital. Okay, so this system of these interlocking colleges and universities, we are capturing the best and the brightest for a certain number of years, and we want to turn them into what we want to turn them into. You know,
right.
It's like one of these talent camps that popped up at the time that Zuckerberg became famous, and it turned out that he and Lady Gaga and Sergey Brin of Google all went to the same talent camp as kids in whatever it was, North Carolina, South Carolina, summer camp. You know, we're talking about talent spotters who say,
right,
well, these kids are very bright, so let's bring them together here and, you know, let's see what we can do and shape the culture, shape this, shape that. So now just kind of multiply that by God knows how many millions of young kids at these colleges and universities, and you see the same kind of operation in progress. Well, we can put these students in the graduate program in genetics, and we can put those into the cloning stuff, and we can put this into the pharmaceutical research, and that into the brain mapping, and so on and so forth. And we got them. We got them for the rest of their life.
Yeah, you know, one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do is explain to people the extraordinary amount of time and money spent on personnel management from basically the crib. You know, it just, you know, if you've been an insider, you've seen it, but it's hard for people who haven't been an insider to believe it's really that intense. But it's extraordinary investment in sort of livestock management. It's incredible. One other thing I wanted to bring up, John, and that is I am finding in the last 6 to 12 months an extraordinary number of what I would call unbelievably intelligent, well-educated, very capable people, very effective people, suddenly kind of waking up. And the problem they have is they can't fathom that things are really as nuts as they are. But, and so usually, you know, there are different fact patterns, but one of the things that happens is they decide that things are crazy. And the next thing you know, they get on the internet and read all the wrong people who are trying to scare them to death. And then ultimately they find one of us, you know, they find you or they find me or they, you know, they find one of our sort of group and they start to read and they're like, it's like me reading your interviews long ago in the '90s. It's like, yeah, that's true. And that's true. And that's true. And wow. I can't understand my world. You know, these are people who can deal with the complexity that it takes because it, you know, I mean, I, you know, you got 1,000 pages of interviews, and to understand your world, you need to read all of them. So, that's why somebody says, well, wait, you know, can I just read a couple hundred? I said, no, you got to read them all. Anyway, so I'm really optimistic that if you get enough people understanding what's really going on, it can help prevent the roller coaster from not rolling over everybody and everything. You know, all you need is a 10% to stay coherent, and it has a remarkable impact on the field. So any thoughts on how we kind of help the professors and university students to understand the madness that's upon them? I mean, they're a target of a covert op, and they don't know it, and a lot of it's about money and power, and they don't see it.
Well, I think that this conversation would go a long way toward waking a lot of people up, for sure. And the alternative, which they're very close to. I mean, you know, the line between saying this is a horrendous imitation of what an education should be and saying now this is what it would really look like, that's a very thin line.
Right.
If you're right there on a campus and, you know, this is what they're doing, to cross from one side to another to find a way, this can be done. And if not, you know, you just get out. Sometimes
right.
you're in a position, a person's in a position where they say, no, this just isn't going to work. I know what would work, and so I'm going to get it and invent it and find it, whatever, someplace else. Or I'm going to find a way to make this happen right here and, you know, get more of the kind of authentic power that I want. I think this conversation would go a very long way. And also to just try to say to people, well, look, you know, if you were to just shrug off everything that's happening around you for a minute, if you could just put it off on the shelf, you know, what would a good education really look like? What would it
right.
do? How would it work? You know, I mean, just remember when you thought that was possible, you know? So bring that back. Like, what is that? Flesh it out. Spell it out.
Right.
You know, because this is what we're talking about. And forget for the moment how you're going to get that. But if you just know what it would look like and what it would be, you're 50% there because, you know, in any situation, you've got that choice. Somehow I'm going to make this work and get what I need out of it. Or if that's not possible, I'm just going to say bye-bye and find it on my own. But I know what it is. I know what it looks like. I know what it should be. So it's not going to be that hard for me to get it. And if more students woke up to that and more professors, we would see some very interesting things happening. Because I got to
You'd stop tolerating something that is, you know, is now has reached a point of, you know, it's so dysfunctional, it's not even worth struggling with anymore.
Exactly.
I just have to tell a story I keep telling. I've been so impressed with it. When I was down in Texas last, I ran into a guy who I'd met by email for a while, but I had never met him in person. And he's a real tall Texan. You know, he's just a big Texas guy, must be 6'6" or even taller. And my guess from looking at him, he probably weighed about 200 pounds. So he said to me, he said, you know, I used to weigh 600 pounds, but I lost, you know, so he clearly lost about 400 pounds. And I said, oh my God. I said, how did you do that? And he looked at me with this great twinkle in his eye and he said, visualization.
Wow.
And, you know, but it's true. You got to visualize, you got to feel it in your cells. That, you know, what it could be. And when you see what it could be, you get so excited. So that's why, you know, for years I used to always come back to the popsicle index. Imagine a world where you're intellectually safe, emotionally safe, financially safe, physically safe, and free to invent. Wow. Yeah.
Now ideas begin popping up like popcorn when you do that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's right. This and that. You know. And then, yeah. So now you're feeling this influx of energy and enthusiasm, and then you look around and you say, okay, so now I'm looking at the land of the zombies. All right. But this is different because now I know the difference between what I've got going here inside me, what I've imagined and visualized, you know, and that out there. Okay, that's a, you know, that may not be everything that I would hope for, but that's the way it is. So now what can I do? What do I want to do? How do I want to work this new right. knowledge that I have, given what we've got going around us here. And then you come up with something, and it works, and right. you make it work, and you work at it, and other people become interested because they see that you've got something that resembles what they've got under the surface, too. And it becomes contagious, and it works. And on campuses, you just have no idea how this could flourish, because there are, in fact, a lot of students who are grinding away, and they feel the friction between what they thought it was going to be and what it turned out to be. And no matter how they try to stuff that down and bury it, their original vision of it, it's still there. And if you wake right. that up, they're going to wake up and they're going to say, what the heck am I doing here? I got to figure right. out a better way. Professors as well. Professors that are going to just say, stop the music. This has gone too far.
Right. Right. I don't know how many professors are still tenured, but I'm hoping enough that can say enough and do enough, because you know, I think what every university, the professors have to get together and build Faraday cages. And then, then everybody has to be able to go into the Faraday cages.
Right, well.
And, you know, they can call them detox cages and
yeah.
detox rooms, and they can go detox and think clearly. Well, John, this has been really tremendous. I can't wait to post this on the Salieri Report. I think
yeah,
this will be useful for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so... I know you've been following this, and you've been writing some incredible stuff on your site. So if you could just take a minute and describe your site again and some of what you've been doing, and how, for the people who don't sign up to get your emails, they should really do it.
Okay, sure. It's nomorefakenews.com. And yes, we have a free email list, and you can get daily pretty much articles sent to you, and you can read all the articles right there on the site. And I keep, you know, boring in on these important subjects like the one we're talking about now, providing different angles to see, and with the idea that has already borne a lot of fruit over the years, because I've been doing that site since 2001, that people will take the ball and run with it. They'll say,
right.
oh, yeah, okay, so let me see now. What do I want to do? And they change their course, and they do something different. That's the whole point. So feel free to drop in and read some articles.
Right. So there's this great scene in World War Z where Brad Pitt is trying to explain to a family that they've got to leave because the zombies are coming. And he said, in situations like this, movement is life. Movement is life. So if you want to learn how to move... Read No More Fake News and John Rappaport. John, it's been a pleasure. You have a great evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kat. Bye.